Hello and welcome to episode 71 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenu.
And this week, we're bringing you our conversation with Natasha Scripture. She's a mixed Desi author, poet, activist, and former aid worker. As a spokesperson for the United Nations, Natasha covered humanitarian crises around the world, including conflicts and natural disasters in Ethiopia, Haiti, Libya, and Pakistan. And before the UN, she worked as a writer, a producer, and editor for a variety of organizations, including the BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera English, TED, and National Geographic.
Natasha has also contributed to the New York Times, The Telegraph, and The Atlantic, among other publications. She's lived in several different countries and has traveled extensively. Yet no matter where she is in the world, she seeks to inspire and empower women with her writing and storytelling. And today, we discuss her new book, Man Fast. We speak about her identity as a half-Desi, her mother is Pakistani-Indian and her father is an American, and the timeline that society imposes on women based on biological clocks and the need to settle down, something we always hear about in our Desi community. She also talks to us about her journey of coping with loss and reinventing herself. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show.
Welcome to the show, Natasha. It's such a pleasure to talk to someone that I kind of want to swap lives with, because I remember reading the first two pages of your book and telling Meenal immediately that I want your life.
Well, I'm very flattered and honored that you say that. Thank you. I do feel like I've had an exciting life, but I created it. I wanted an exciting life, and I'm glad that it comes across that way in the book. I'm not like that every day. I mean, I'm a normal person too, so it's not constant adventure, but I do have a real kind of addiction to adventure and trying new things.
You know, even just before we started recording, we were going through the introduction we would give to our audience, and your list of accomplishments is just endless, Natasha. So it really is so great to speak to someone who's worked alongside so many incredible journalists and activists, and I really can't wait to hear more about your life, and I'm sure we'll take a lot from this interview today.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to share whatever.
So like I mentioned earlier, Natasha, I honestly told Meenal that I want a career path that resembles yours, because it's so hard to put you in a box. You worked with the media, with UN, you're a writer, and you've also traveled extensively. So you talk about being a nomad of sorts in your book. But in our community, this title of a nomad is often associated with men. Women from our South Asian community generally don't have ambitions to be nomads. And even if they do, there are just so many forces discouraging them from pursuing such ambitions. But growing up in America, of all places, in a half-Desi, half-American household, did you ever feel that you were doing something different by pursuing this career trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely true. I think both for American and Indians. I mean, I think just the path of being a UN aid worker is quite different. I like to use the term GLOMAD, global nomad. You know, I think that when you grow up in a multicultural household exposed to, you know, various backgrounds, like I grew up going to India quite a bit. I think I was one when we first, or maybe even younger, when my mom, my dad, we all went. So I think I got the travel bug from a really early age. And my dad worked for the airlines. He was with Singapore Airlines for a while. So we traveled quite a bit that way. So I just love movement. I love meeting new people and seeing new places. Like I said, it's kind of an addiction. And it is a little bit different. I remember, you know, when I go and I stay for an extended period in Bombay or Mumbai, and then I want to kind of trek off somewhere that, like, you know, is a little bit dangerous, quote unquote, for women. My family's always like, no, you can't go there. You can't travel alone to Delhi as a woman. I'm like, okay, I can do it. You know, I've been in like Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Haiti. So it's funny because it's just a lot more conservative in that sense, compared to the American side, which is like, that's cool. But I don't know a lot of people, of course, in my industry, I know a lot of people who travel and lived everywhere. But, you know, generally, I think, you know, I do think it's been a blessing to have worked for the UN and to have seen all the things that I've seen.
And there was there are many profound ideas in your book, but there was one thing that really stuck to me, and that you mentioned that while you were working as an aid worker for the UN, you were surrounded by many women who may have put their personal life on hold in order to pursue their dream jobs as activists or journalists. And many people, especially in our community, look down on women who dream of having these kinds of careers. But it's a bit difficult for them because they feel like going into this line of work may halt, you know, anything in like their married life or having kids in their future. But do you think men are looked at in the same way? Not just in our community, but globally, is their career choice ever questioned if they choose a path like this?
I mean, no, it's very different being a man, obviously, in our community and also just generally in the world. The women that you mentioned, they're called, and this is not a flattering term, but they're called humanitarian widows. And it's basically because the work is so interesting and because you get to travel and because, you know, you get compensated well, and you just kind of keep on that trajectory, and then you don't really, and it's hard to settle down and meet someone because, you know, you're just kind of passing through places, or you have these kind of flings, like I like to write about in my book, you know, these 2-3 week flings, and then the person that you had the fling with moved back to wherever he was from. But then you can continue on, and it's quite, you know, and then you could just lose track of time and you're like, oh my God, I forgot to have babies. So, but not every woman, of course, wants to have a family. And, you know, I guess I kind of talk about how I'm in two minds about that. I mean, I do want it, but I don't want to feel like I have to be on this, be restricted in any way, you know, because I've, you know, there are a lot of mostly men in the industry that I've been in who've had both a family and they get to, you know, globetrot. There are women as well, of course, but I think that if you're always mobile, it's harder to meet someone and settle down, you know, plant roots somewhere. I definitely think it's different for men generally, of course, because they don't have a biological clock in the same way. So they don't have the same kind of anxiety. And I also think, I mean, I do think that Indian men or South Asian men face pressures from their mothers, et cetera, to meet a nice girl and settle down. But I think if they've wandered off and done something different, I think it's just not looked at in such a negative way that the way it is with women. I remember telling my aunt, who I called Davy in the book, that I wanted to, you know, I think I was moving to Bangkok for a UN assignment. And she's like, okay, well, you've chosen to be a career woman and not a married woman. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait a minute, like, why do I have to choose? So there is kind of that mentality. I mean, she worked for Air India for many years and she just never met anybody that she liked enough to marry. And I think back then, you know, that was quite unusual. But, you know, my mother, as I write about in the book, she's found the love of her life and she had a full-fledged career. So, you know, I don't think it has to be one or the other.
And Natasha, I'm from Kerala, and from your book, I've gathered that you quite like my state.
I love Kerala. I mean, it's so lush and gorgeous and beautiful. And I actually felt super safe traveling there. Not that I, you know, generally feel nervous as a traveler because I've traveled so much, but because everyone's like, don't travel alone in India. I was just, you know, I felt very, very safe. I didn't feel like, I think in other parts of India, maybe it's slightly different, but
yeah.
It's just so beautiful, the backwaters. I mean, I just love all the nature. I love the ashram that I was staying at. I love the food, you know.
And one of my personal favorite parts of the book, I think, is your conversation with Sita from Kerala. And she was a 22-year-old shop girl with two children, and she was astonished to find out that you were not married. So do you want to tell our listeners the simplicity of her views regarding your marriage and relationships? Not yours, but in marriage and relationships in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny because I was doing this man fast, right? Detoxing from the search for the one and all of that. And so I was sort of wandering around Varkala and I walked into this shop and it was so hot. And you're just kind of looking at the clothes and they're all so pretty dangling there. And then I start chatting with the shop girl and she's like, oh, you know, where are you from? And, you know, I don't know, she asked me how old I was and I told her. And, you know, I think almost more than like 15 years older than she is. And she's like, are you married with kids? And I was like, no. And she just looked like she was about to faint. it's just so different, you know, culturally it's so different. And I remember, you know, she had these two boys that were running around the shop and we had this really kind of not deep conversation, but, she was asking me, I said, oh, well, maybe I'll do it on my own with a sperm donor and everything. And then I was like, I don't know why I'm getting into this with her. Sometimes, you know, when you're traveling, you're just so open and expressive. And she got really confused by the sperm donor concept. She thought I meant like there was a bank and there was sperm in it. And I just don't think I explained it well. But there is this idea that, you know, if you're not married at a certain age, like, how could that be? How could that be? Because, you know, all Indian women, of course, I'm half Indian, but, you know, at this age, you're expected to be married and have a family. And, you know, she culturally just, that's how it is. And she was introduced to her husband. It was an arranged marriage. And I don't know, I think for me, in that moment, because she was like, have you been to Goa? I was like, of course I've been to Goa. I mean, it's like right around the corner, really. I've been there a bunch of times. And she's like, oh, I've always wanted to go. And I thought, wow, she probably won't ever go. And then I kind of really started to recognize, wow, I'm really lucky that I have this freedom. On the other hand, the simplicity of her life was really appealing to me. Just, you know, in some weird way, I was like, it's so simple. It's basic, but not, I don't mean in a derogatory way, but it was just like, you know, it was just family and work, and she would be in that town probably forever. And she didn't seem unhappy in any way. So again, I think it's just a matter of women just being able to have to choose for themselves and to not be judged by others for whatever they choose. And also part of it is just like surrendering to your path. I mean, maybe if I'd met the love of my life, I would have gotten married and had kids, but it just didn't happen that way. Not yet. So yeah.
She said something like, what's so hard about marriage? You just find someone, you live with them forever, something like that.
Yeah, she did say that. And I had to laugh because I was like, obviously she's never been on Tinder. I think, you know, I don't know if it exists in Kerala, but I think, yeah, there is this idea that it's so easy, just pick a guy. But I talk about this a lot in the book. Mm-hmm. It's like this paradox of choice issue, right? You know, the Barry Schwartz book.
We will get to that a bit later, Natasha, because, you know, we have our own idea in our community, especially about what it's like to find a guy. And people like Sita think, well, just find a guy, get married, have kids. That's your life. But for us, it's a bit different because we've been raised in a different culture. We've seen a lot more in our lives that we have a different, completely different perception on what it's like to get married and give ourselves to another person.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the more exposure you have, it's almost like you want to keep your options open. And I know we'll talk about that. But when she's asking, you know, why haven't you just met somebody? It makes me think I'm crazy because it's like, of course, I met like millions of people. But is it
us? Here's the thing, Natasha. Like, I feel like a lot of our listeners from the Desi community are going to have a similar view to Sita's. Maybe not all of them would think that marrying a stranger and having two kids by the age of 22 is the norm, but it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for them. So, and on the other hand, much like Sita, they would look at you and they would think, oh, you have it all. You have the looks, education, you have a great career, you have experience, you have everything. So do you ever worry that a South Asian audience would have difficulty relating to the journey of self-discovery that you describe in the book?
I haven't worried about it because while I was writing the book, I was just writing my authentic story. I'm hoping that at least parts of it will resonate with women. Maybe not all of it will, but, you know, I don't want to settle. For me, like if in my gut it doesn't feel right, I just can't do it. You know, sometimes I've been in situations and I talk about it in my book where I try to make something work with someone, even though it just doesn't feel right. And the other thing is that I grew up exposed to my parents who were very, very much in love, very different, two completely different cultures, but so complementary just in terms of their temperaments and just personalities and everything. And so I saw that true love story unfolding in front of me for my, you know, my whole life. And so then my expectations are quite high. You know, so for men as well. But yeah, I mean, I guess there's definitely going to be women who are like, why can't you just stop being so picky? But it's like, well, why do I have to be? Why can't I just live my life? It's pretty friggin' great. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and if I really want a baby, you know, I can obviously just go to one of those banks.
Yeah, or adopt. There's so many orphans in the world.
Exactly, or adopt. I mean, there's so many ways to do it. And I do feel like this is a very fortunate time to be a woman because we have so many options. If we want to have a family, we can adopt, we can have a baby with a gay friend, which I've talked about doing. You know, there's so many different things that we can do and that maybe are unconventional for certain communities. But I think, you know, change happens gradually. And yeah.
Yeah. And here's the thing. I've personally been thinking about this a lot, Natasha, because I've been thinking why it's mostly women who go on these self-actualization journeys when they either hit a low point or they experience loss, something tremendous happens in their lives, and they start, you know, thinking about their lives and what it means to them. And it's not often that you hear about men doing the same, is it?
Well, I think when you hear about men, it's often in relation to a midlife crisis, right? Okay, so he's like in his 50s and he bought a fancy sports car and he got a girlfriend or a mistress on the side. But I do have to say that, you know, men do have these kinds of journeys. In fact, I have a very close friend who took a sabbatical from the UN for a year, and he's walking his way around the world, essentially. So right now he's in England and he just wanted to walk. He wanted to kind of just... He'd been working in humanitarian emergencies for a long time and just, you know, was in his mid-40s. He's like, I just need to do something for myself. And so he's just, you know, it's kind of like the idea behind the Camino de Santiago, but he's doing it in England and then he's going to South Africa. So I do think that men do these journeys for sure. I mean, do they write about them? Maybe they're not as comfortable being so kind of
vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yeah, exactly. Yeah. On the page. I think we're more inclined to express ourselves in that way. But, you know, Dante writes about it. I mean, there's different ways that they write about it. Joseph Campbell. So I do think that men have similar journeys for sure. It's just that we like to talk and share as women, right?
Well, just going back to Sita's story and your encounter with her, Ankita mentioned that, you know, a lot of people, especially in India, will look at you and think, well, Natasha pretty much has everything going for her. But I think something important to think about is, like, if you look at happiness, of course, we know it's all relative. And there's also like a certain hierarchy that we have. And I think, like, you know, you can only consider buying a house if you can already afford to buy food, and you can only consider traveling around the world if you can afford to, like, you know, pay your mortgage or whatever. So for someone like you, you've already filled out a lot of the boxes that complete most people's so-called void of happiness. And as Ankita did mention, that, you know, from the outside, your life and journey leaves very little room to be dissatisfied. I mean, that's what it looks like from the outside. But obviously, as I said, there's a hierarchy. So, for example, someone like Sita, her needs are so different and her expectations from life are so different. And I think it's also quite safe to say, like, her bar for happiness is, and again, not in a derogatory way, but it would be lower than ours. So do you find it difficult to connect with these kind of people? And if someone actually came up to you and said, like, Natasha, you know, you shouldn't even be thinking that you don't have enough happiness in your life, how do you try to connect with them, and how do you try to sort of explain your feelings behind all of this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and it's quite fair. First of all, I definitely connect to women like Sita. I talk about it in the book, about my experiences working in refugee camps, the women that I met, the resilience that I saw. Like, I almost felt it was a transcendent experience to me. I was so inspired by these women, by the way that they've overcome some of the struggles that we could never even fathom. So I definitely connect, and I don't know why I connect, but I do. I feel their pain. I think, you know, I consider myself to be an empath, okay, even though I haven't gone through an earthquake in Haiti personally or lost my family due to war. I feel that human connection with them, and I'm inspired by the way that they've managed to forge ahead, how they've managed to survive and often thrive. So I don't think, you know, I can connect with people from different backgrounds for sure. I think there's always commonalities, right? Just even being a woman is a commonality, or complaining about men. That's, I mean, you know, actually it's funny because anywhere you go in the world, rich or poor, women are always complaining about men. So it's just funny. But you know, not that there's something wrong with every man. Of course there isn't, but it's just a funny way to bond and break the ice sometimes. But yeah, I can see how maybe people would be like, you've got everything, you've seen so much poverty. How could you feel sad? How could you want more? How could you want love? But what my answer to that is that suffering does not discriminate based on, you know, your status or your class or the amount of money you have in the bank. I mean, we all suffer. That is the shared human experience, right? I mean, I've gone through my fair share as I write about it. I've grieved just because I might, you know, have a house, which actually I don't. But anyway, you know, if I have some, you know, just because I have a credit card or whatever, it doesn't mean that like I'm not going to feel pain in the same way. I mean, some of the richest people in the world are the most depressed. I think what we're all searching for is that connectedness with ourselves, our real, that kind of core, that spirit inside us. I think we're all looking for that, but we don't really know that we are. And so we're searching for it often in the wrong places, in relationships, in acquisitions or material goods, in experiences, which can lead you to that, of course. But I think that's what we all ultimately are going towards, is home, which, you know, I write about in the book, is that place inside, right?
And we've touched upon men and their midlife crisis just a little bit, but there's something else that you mentioned in the book, which I'm sure we've all thought about, but not a lot of people say that often, which is that women are commitment phobes too, and that women go through a midlife crisis too.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, that's like one of the big messages that I want to get across. It's like, why do men get to have the midlife crises? They don't. I've had one. I mean, you know, I don't think that midlife crises discriminate against gender. You know, I think we hear about it more often. I also think that I do believe that women are able to juggle more. Honestly, I know that's a generalization, but I've just seen it with my married friends, that juggling, you know, kids and career, and just I think that I don't want to say that men are the weaker sex, because that's not fair. But in some ways they are. In some ways they are. I mean, maybe not physically, okay, but if we're going to generalize a little bit. But so I think their midlife crisis is quite dramatic in some ways, because I don't know, whereas women, I guess we're kind of conditioned to be able to do a lot of things. I mean, that's just kind of our nature. I think when you're a mother, even, like, it's just part of our, like, biology to be able to handle a lot. So I think when we have a midlife crisis, maybe it's more subtle. I don't know. Do men need more attention? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. I almost want to argue with myself about this.
Yeah. And even about being commitment phobes. I mean, in India, if you say the word commitment phobe, everyone just thinks about Salman Khan and that's it.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Well, it definitely has a stigma, that term. But I always liked being like, I'm a commitment phobe, because it felt empowering to me. It's like, well, I don't want to commit because I don't have to commit, because I don't need anybody, because I'll never have to depend on a man financially, which is really huge, obviously. You know, and I do think that, especially if we're looking at South Asia and certain kind of class structures that don't allow for women to sort of work outside of the household, et cetera. And then they really do need to have a husband in order to survive, right? So it's very different there. And I do recognize that.
And there are also many women there who take a career break sometimes of up to a decade. And, you know, they have and raise their kids during that time. But the support they have in order to return to the workforce is not that great in most developing countries. Because, and that too, the angst that they go through while managing a home, taking care of their kids and their in-laws, and living with this realization that they might never get employed again, despite all of their capabilities, that is never categorized as a midlife crisis. Nobody ever talks about it.
Right. I mean, I think in a way, it's like we have to redefine what a midlife crisis is. I mean, or how it expresses itself. And I think it's an individual experience. It's not like we're all making some huge announcement or going on a 9-month man fast and writing a book about it. I mean, I think it could just be, it could be so many things. It could be so quiet. It could be personal. It could just be a bit of a depression. It could be like spurred by divorce, or, you know, of course, Elizabeth Gilbert, I think she probably would call her kind of divorce a midlife crisis, which spurred on her whole journey, which she writes about in Eat, Pray, Love. So same with Cheryl Strayed and Wilde. Mm-hmm. It often has to do with leaving the known for the unknown, right? And that's what I love so much. There's this book that I quote at the back of my book that's called The Heroine's Journey. It's by Maureen Murdoch. I love that book so much. It's not really that well known, but it's like kind of the female version of Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, because it is quite different what we go through. It's mm-hmm. a different kind of, it's a different journey. It is. And the way she describes it is that essentially we kind of reject the feminine when we move into our 20s, and then we try to adopt this masculine approach to success, mm-hmm. right? And we're constantly mm-hmm. achieving and striving and conquering. And then we get to this place where we just felt so disconnected with our feminine self. And then that's mm-hmm. kind of where I think I was when I started my journey. It's like, you know, I talk about Shakti energy. I just felt this different energy kind of rising through me. And I was just really stunned by it. And then there's ultimately the reintegration of the feminine and the masculine. So I think it's really interesting to look at things that way.
Yeah. And you mentioned Elizabeth Gilbert and Eat, Pray, Love earlier. Did you get inspired by her journey to either take your journey or to even write about it? Because I was unconsciously, I feel I was drawing a few parallels. You went to India, you went to Italy, you were going through different experiences in different continents. Did you unconsciously also draw inspiration from a work like that?
No, I did not. I think she's great. I love her work, but I didn't really plot out my journey. I just knew that I had to get out of New York City. And I started off in Mexico City. There's whole chapters I didn't even include. And then I was going to India because I wanted to do the Ayurveda. You know, India is like my second home, right? So I had India before Elizabeth Gilbert. No, but you know what I mean? That's like my roots. And I always feel like India is where I go to sort of check in with myself and, you know, it's where I have family. It's just, it just makes sense. And then of course, but I wanted to go to Kerala, which I hadn't been to because I was really interested in deepening my meditation practice and studying Ayurveda and really investing in my mind, body, spirit connection. And then I ended up in Sicily. Again, I lived in Rome for several years and I have a lot of Italian friends. And I went to Sicily because a friend of mine, she quit her job in London and she basically started her own retreat center and she wanted me to come and be one of the first people. And I was so inspired by the fact that she'd been talking about it literally the year before and she actually did it. And I love being around women who do those things. And so I was like, any excuse to go to Sicily, because I actually hadn't been yet. So I ended up in Sicily and, you know, while I was there, I was like, you know, I already knew that I wanted to reconnect with nature in a really deep way. So I was planning on working on a farm, but I wasn't sure where. And she was like, well, you should do it in Sicily. There's so much nature. And then of course, you know, I end up woofing, which is kind of an interesting experience. And then, you know, I was in Sicily for quite a bit working on that vineyard. And then I ended up going to Tanzania for work. So it kind of just flowed. It's funny. I talk about flow in the book. I didn't like map it out. In fact, the proposal that I sold to my publisher is completely different from what I wrote. I just sort of was deciding. I didn't know in January where I'd be in August or in July. I didn't know I was going to be in Tanzania, but I was okay with that too, you know. And I also think that I was working at the same time and I had this amazing opportunity to telecommute for the UN, which obviously helped because it does cost money to travel, etc. But yeah, I mean, I think in a way, I mean, my book is similar to hers. But I also think it's different because I talk a lot about, you know, losing my dad, of course. I talk mm-hmm. about being from two different cultures. I talk a lot about my humanitarian work. When I first pitched the book actually to my agent, I was like, it's going to be Eat, Pray, Love in a refugee camp. And it was sort of, yeah. So there are elements of that, I think, in the book. But I also didn't want to bore people with, like, you know, my development aid work kind of experiences. I feel like that's a very niche audience. And I just sort of touched on it here and there just so people could get a sense of what it was like being in these places. But I didn't want to get into the nitty gritty.
Well, Natasha, a lot of women who are tuning in to this episode might agree with me when I say that to some extent, especially women, we're sort of groomed to feel like women have to compromise in our relationships. And even just like the other day, my mom said to me, as a passing comment, that she said to me, you know, Mil, you will marry into someone else's family. So you have to compromise and you have to be able to mend your ways to make other people happy. And we're told that women have to respect their in-laws, their husband's choices. And that's probably why divorce and separation is never usually a question in Desi families. At least now maybe it's getting a bit better. But back then, in my mother's time, for example, even just 10 years ago, it was never heard of. But from your book, we feel that you have quite the opposite mentality. Like, you know, it seems like you have a certain criteria you want to see in a man. And even the slightest red flag makes you think twice. And there was one incident in your book where you told your then boyfriend, if I was going to be alone forever, it would be because I wanted exactly that. So this is just something that Ankita and I were thinking about. And do you feel that to some extent your struggles to be in long-term relationships doesn't necessarily stem from the other guys? Maybe it's an inner emotion that stops you from going further when you see a slight like red flag? Because as women in this day and age, you know, we're told to be strong, fearless, and to stand our ground. And the idea of compromise usually isn't part of the question. Why do you think you're so, how can I say, maybe not so flexible in mending your ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is an inner resistance, of course. I mean, this fear between, you know, I sort of waver between like feeling like I might get swallowed up by someone or a relationship and lose myself. And just then wanting the other extreme of just sort of wanting to be alone. So it's just like, I kind of float between those two. I mean, the guy that you're referring to in the book was definitely not my boyfriend. He was a fling when I fell off my man fast in Sicily, as one does. There was no way that there would ever have been a future with him. But I have to say, it's true, I do have high standards, but I don't think I'm ridiculous. Now, a lot of people could argue with me. That's fine. I mean, all of my Indian kind of relatives and my Indian kind of older Indian friends, like, she's so picky. Why doesn't she just meet a nice guy? You know, and they all blame me. There's something wrong with me because like, why could, you know, but it's just like, it's really hard to meet someone you want to share the rest of your life with. I mean, it's hard to like choose someone. And I also think we're all on our own journeys. And I do, to a certain extent, trust in the kind of the flow. I think I've been single for so long for a reason. I think this deep spiritual work that I did the past couple of years, most of which I document in this book, I would not have been able to go where I went if I'd been in a relationship. Actually, to be honest, I think that our most incredible, most creative, most vulnerable, authentic selves come when we're in our darkest moments, which is kind of where I was when I started this. Like, really this feeling of despondency, you know, just the breakup that I had, obviously, just this questioning, right? And so that's why I start the book with the Rilke quote, living the questions. But because I felt like the journey was really about living the questions. But, you know, for me, it's like one of the big things that I feel like I learned on this kind of 9-month rebirthing, if you will, was that I feel like I always focused so much on romantic love and kind of neglected the fact that I have so many different kinds of love in my life. You know, the family love with my parents and then, you know, my niece, my brother, and then of course all my female friendships, as I point out in the book, like women are staying single longer. So we just have these like incredible, deep female friendships. I have them with my married friends, girlfriends, but also with my single girlfriends who are kind of getting up to the same kind of thing. And so those are really powerful friendships. It's an amazing community. And then of course, all the communities I'm a part of, you know, the ashrams that I've stayed at and the yoga community and now the Ayurveda community. It's like, I feel like there's so many, and writers, of course, now I'm just meeting all kinds of authors because now that I'm an author, I can actually say that's crazy. So this idea that I'm alone, I just don't feel like I'm alone. I feel like there's so much love. And that's why I reference the Greeks and how they were so kind of advanced, even in ancient Greece, because they have Eros, which is what we're talking about here, right? But then so many different kinds of like names for love, right? You know, the agape, the spiritual love, there's the, you know, the platonic love. And I think sometimes that we as a society or women or Desis get so like focused on romantic love, on Eros. And I'm like, whoa, hold up, you know? Yeah, and I do believe that love is our true nature. And I know that gets kind of kooky sounding, but that was really ultimately where I ended up, was that like I didn't need to look for love because I was love. I don't know if that made sense at all when you read that, but hopefully it did, because it really made sense.
Yeah, you did spell it out like that itself. You said, I am love, and that was pretty profound when you did it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling, I guess, but your question, like, why don't I just pick somebody? I'm like, well, why should I, right? If I have companionship.
I think Natasha, I mean, it's not even just about picking someone. And you mentioned, like, you mentioned that when you are alone and when you're in your most vulnerable state and probably in your lowest points in your life, it's when your true self and your true character starts to blossom. And I totally agree with that. But I think that also there's a time, I think life plays out in different phases, not all the time. There's no formula, but I think that if you went through these learning points in your 20s, your early 20s or your late 20s, even in your early 30s, when you got to where you are now, do you feel like you've done enough learning? Do you feel like the curves will not spike anymore? And do you feel like now, okay, you know who the person you are and you know the kind of life you want to have. So do you think that there's a line where you should be like, okay, I know the person I am. Now I think it's time to see where I can go in a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think we're always learning and growing and evolving. It's almost exhausting when you think about it. It's like you're never done, right? You're always going to change and evolve, hopefully, because that's what we're supposed to do. And that's why it's actually so hard to pick a partner, because especially if you're in your early 20s, because you do a lot of it in your 20s and 30s, right? And then that's why when people sometimes get married or get into these long relationships in their early 20s, they separate because they pick someone, but they grow apart, right? Because you don't really know who you are then, right? So then you grow apart and then maybe get divorced. Or of course, in South Asia, it's more of a stigma. So you stay together, but you're miserable. So yeah, I would say that I'm definitely closer to knowing what I want. I mean, the person I would have picked at 30, I don't think I would have been with him for sure. But then I don't think there's a formula either. I mean, I definitely, I do feel like weirdly, I always wanted to be a writer, and writing this book to me was like a birthing process. And I do feel like I am now on the other side of something, whatever that something is, you know, I don't know, but I feel like I've climbed over a mountain and I'm on the other side. And I don't feel, I think before I had some anxiety and some self-doubt. So I am really comfortable with who I am and where I am. And I just feel like that's kind of where you want to be when you kind of attract or meet somebody, is feeling really whole. And I think I talk a lot about that in the book, the sense of wholeness, right? Like, because we're conditioned to think that we're incomplete as women without a partner, et cetera, or especially in Desi culture, like that's just one of the boxes you tick. And, you know, of course, I talk about that fortune teller when I was 9 years old, and he told my mom that I would marry into a really rich, lovely family and I'd be happy forever with my husband and kids. And so it's like, oh, I was like 9 years old and I just, you know, really wanted candy. So when you're brainwashed with that at such a young age, it's really hard to deconstruct and kind of almost detox from that. And so that was part of the process in this book. Is like, if I don't end up with these things that I'm told that I'm supposed to have, I'm still going to be fine. I'm still going to be whole. And it's like, how do I carve out my own authentic life path if I'm not willing to settle with someone that I don't feel I'm connected with, or I don't have a synergy with, which I'm not. And I know women are, and that's fine. And everybody's, it's up to you to make that decision. I'm just saying that I'm not, I would have done that by now if I was that type of person, right? So how do I feel whole and complete? How do I feel like I'm living my purpose? And I actually really feel, and it's the most incredible feeling, and it almost makes you want to cry, because it's like, I actually feel like I'm living my purpose, which is so divine, because so many people go through their lives and they don't actually know why they're here, and they're just like really frantically busy. And it's almost like they're afraid of finding out why they're here. And I talk a lot about, obviously, in the first chapter, especially this mindful approach to life, how I just sort of lost this mindfulness. Like it was just one thing to do to the next, right? And, you know, but we really need to slow down and in order to meet our truest selves, right? And people are afraid of that.
And you talk about a lot of strong women in your book. And your mother, I believe, has been a very strong female presence in your life, hasn't she?
Oh boy, yeah, she has. I mean, she's definitely quite a woman. She's everyone's favorite character. She insists that I made up everything, which I did not make up a single thing. In fact, there was a lot of stuff I couldn't put in the book because I was like, Mom, we're going to get like arrested. I don't know. She's really funny. She's really amazing. She's really strong. She's this interesting mix of West and East because, you know, she immigrated to the U.S. when she was 19, born in Karachi, the year of partition, grew up in Bombay. And then, you know, her brothers had actually immigrated to Canada before her. And then, so she's been in the U.S. longer. I'm always like, Mom, you're so American, you know, because she'll eat hamburgers or whatever. I'm like, but then she's also so Indian in so many ways, like her mentality. And, you know, a lot of the book is about this kind of, not tension between us, because she's like my best friend, really. So it's just about like, she wants me to meet someone and settle down still today. You know, it's like, she's like, any cute boys? I mean, which is how I start off the whole book. Like, I'm like, Mom, I just wrote a book about how I'm happy and whole on my own. Like, so, I mean, she is a strong figure. She's a strong presence in my life. You know, my dad was different.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, can you tell us about your parents' relationship and the dynamic that they used to share? Because I feel like even for a half Desi family in the 80s, your family life growing up must have been quite different to that of your peers.
Yeah, it was different. Definitely. I mean, we had basically Indian food Monday through Friday, because we had a nanny who would cook. She was a Parsi woman. And then the weekends we had American food or like Italian, like spaghetti, pizza. And so it really was a blend of East and West. I definitely feel, you know, I guess I was the only half Indian girl or Indian person maybe in my high school. I don't know. I'm not, yeah, I mean, I think I grew up going to Indian parties and like passing out in the basements of people's homes as one does, you know, at these Indian parties, right? When you're kids, like, but also, you know, I was in the U.S., right? With, you know, an American father. But I definitely think that between the two of them, like she was definitely she was in control. She called the shots, but not in a way that was, you know, aggressive, but you know, my dad was so easygoing. So, you know, they just really, they really complimented each other. But yeah, it was just sort of like very different. You know, her family, and I write about this, was kind of, wasn't entirely happy or convinced when my mom was like, okay, I met an American boy, I'm marrying him. In fact, they tried to stop the wedding, right? Or stop the engagement. And then, of course, she brought him to India and he was so charming. And then eventually, you know, they warmed up to him. And of course, you know, he became a part of the family. And likewise, his family's from upstate New York. And I don't think they'd ever met a woman from India. And my mom was very glamorous. And I don't know what she was wearing the day that she met her in-laws. But, you know, I think they were really just like, who is this woman? Like this Bollywood star. You know, she was in New York, like it was the first time she'd ever seen snow, right? So these are things that it's like, wow, that must have been so crazy to have to have gone through that. You know, in a way, I'm envious of their love story. I mean, it's so amazing. It's so, I could write a whole book about
that. That's the thing. Yeah, Natasha, you're not the first person I know to say that my parents have had such a perfect life that if something doesn't match up to that ideal, I don't want to have that. And Meenal and I have quite a different upbringing, and we both grew up seeing our parents fight quite a bit. So we didn't really grow up thinking, oh my God, they're in love so much. I want to have exactly that. There were times when I would look at my parents and think, I want to have the exact opposite of that. So you're not the first person that I know personally who says that my parents have this ideal relationship, and if it doesn't match up to that, then I don't want it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, and you know, that's a thing. Like, if I've been in a relationship with someone and that person argues, like in Italy, they like to argue. I don't know. Or the boyfriends that I've had, I'm like, oh, this is not comfortable for me. I mean, actually arguing in Italian is fun because it's such a beautiful language, but
I know. How can you get insulted? Like,
yeah, exactly. It sounds so beautiful and it makes you kind of want to argue because it's just so, you know, it's such a, you know, it's sort of
so melodious and
exactly. But you know, my dad never, he just never argued. They never argued. It's so arguing to me is very weird and unhealthy, but that's because I grew up without being exposed to it. I don't even think in private they argued, to be honest. I'm sure they must have had disagreements, but again, he just didn't have that, you know, he was just very gentle. And so I'm very quick to, when I find a man who's like a bit aggressive or what, you know, it just doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel natural. I mean, you can be like quiet and have fortitude and, you know, be strong, but I just don't, I don't know. Arguing just never, it just never felt right or appealed to me. So yeah. So when I meet someone who I feel has that kind of side to him. But you know, there, I have friends who are married and they argue a lot and they kind of both love it. I don't know. They just, they often argue when I'm like, for example, in the house with them and I'm always like, oh my God, this is really uncomfortable. But they do it all the time and it still makes me so uncomfortable because I'm just, it's, to me, it's bad, but it's not. I'm sure arguing is healthy, et cetera. It's just not what I want to spend my days doing, you know?
Mm. But you do talk about having a child and you feel guilty of not giving your father the grandchild he always wanted before he passed away. And you've also mentioned that if you ever have a child, you'd want to see your father reincarnated in your child. So you've had a very deep connection with your father throughout your life. But where does this need and desire to give your father happiness in the form of a grandchild come from?
You know, that's the thing. I mean, he never said he wanted to be a grandfather. And actually, my brother beat me to it. So, like I said, I have a niece and my dad was still alive when she was born. So I feel like he was a great, you know, he was a grandfather. Of course, he was quite sick at the time, but, you know, he held the baby and she was just a gift, obviously, to all of us. To be honest, he loved what I was doing. He thought I had the most exciting life, which I kind of did, you know, just with the UN. I mean, I think he definitely worried about my well-being, just being, you know, in Pakistan or on the border of the Ethiopia-Somalia or in Libya or on the border there with Tunisia during the war. So I think he definitely worried, but he was never like, he never said, oh, come home, be normal and get like a normal office job. I mean, I think he kind of lived vicariously through me. So when I say, oh, I wanted to give my dad a grandchild, I mean, it's not from him. It's, I don't even know where it comes from. I think it's just maybe, yeah, this idea of wanting to reincarnate him, which if I do have a child, I feel like I will in some way. I mean, I do believe that, you know, when you die, you don't actually die, right? Like it's a lot deeper. Yeah. There's a transition that happens. So, I mean, reincarnation is the only thing that really makes sense to me and all the things that I studied and looked at, right? So I kind of know that he's around me. Actually, he was in my dream last night. And I feel like there are different ways that I feel his energy. But there's also ways you can block energies, right? Like, I think when you, and I know my mom does that because she's grieving so much that she kind of sometimes blocks him because she can't deal with her emotions and her sadness. And it's just, you know, grief is just a very, it's a process and it's not, I don't think it's like, you know, certain steps and then you've conquered it. I think it's just, for me, I do believe this is going to be a lifelong thing that I'm coping with, but, you know, and navigating, but I'm okay with it. I can survive it. And I know other people, everybody's grieving in some way. Everybody loses someone at some point, right? And we all survive. It's like, how do we find meaning in that suffering, right?
And you also write in your book about your experience of being attracted to and eventually falling in love with a woman. And like this question of where does this stem from? Where did your need to give your father a grandchild sort of, where did it stem from?
Yeah, no, I don't think it was a result of my man fast. I think love is love. And like, I just, this idea of being like straight or gay, I think it's really kind of archaic. And I think we're slowly getting to a place where it's like, you know, sexuality isn't very black and white. You know, I think there's different gradients of sexuality. And I don't even like the labels bisexual. I think they come with their own slew of issues. But I mean, it's fine if you want to self-identify that way. I don't really put a label on myself. Like I say in the book, I don't look at women that way, you know, but I'm conditioned to look at men.
Yep.
So that's why I don't look at women that way. When I look at a woman, I'm usually admiring her. I'm like, oh, I love her jeans. Where'd she get them? Her hair. You know, it's like, oh, I want something that she has. In a way, with this love story, it was like, I wanted to be her. It wasn't, I don't know if it was something that was dormant in me. I think, you know, I have felt attracted to women before, but I've never like actually considered being permanently with a woman. And there's no reason, there isn't, I mean, I guess I haven't because it was like, no, you marry a man and you have a baby with a man. That's just what we're taught, right? I'm absolutely not against doing that because, you know, but I want to be with someone who, you know, makes me feel great or it just feels like who I feel really connected to and like we have a similar worldview. But this kind of crept up on me and it was sort of like right at the time when I was going on my man fast and it was, I don't think it was because of it. I think I just met someone who I just really became infatuated with. And then, you know, we just had these feelings and there was this attraction. And, I think when you love a woman, it's very different in that way. It's actually kind of amazing because it's almost like, and I might want to argue with myself about this, but it's like, do you love that woman deeper because you understand her heart more because you have the same kind of heart? Because being a woman, it is being different from a man, right? It is different. We do experience the world differently. We have experienced the world differently. You can't argue that. I mean, we can have share a lot of the same grievances and joys, et cetera, but it's just, it is different. And of course, transsexual, that's a whole other thing. I mean, yeah. So sometimes I think I loved her more than I loved any man that I actually was in a relationship with. And I'm not really sure why, except for that maybe because I had more of a connection to her because we were the same gender. I don't know. It's exciting to be with a woman. When you're with like a beautiful woman and, you know, it can be really passionate and she had a lot of power, a lot of self-confidence, but yet at the same time, you know, was quite insecure and, you know, was working through things as well, right, with her divorce and all of that. So, you know, when we get in a relationship, we're bringing our issues, you know, and I probably had a lot of sadness around my dad and, you know, so you work those things out in a relationship, actually. And then, you know, our partners become a mirror to us. And sometimes we see the things that we don't want to see, right? So in a way, it's almost easier to be single because we don't have to deal with that.
But at the very end of your journey, Natasha, you mark it with a very special ceremony. So can you tell us a bit more about your decision to embrace sologamy?
Right. I mean, everyone's kind of fixated on the fact that I marry myself. You know, it's really, I know it sounds like it's actually quite trendy right now. And I don't even think I did it because of that. No, I didn't because I don't even know that I knew that it existed. For me, it was really just symbolism, right? I felt that I should mark the end of the 9 months that, I mean, some people could argue were self-indulgent. Sure, maybe, but you try being an aid worker for years in refugee camps and bouncing around the world, and you see what that does to you because it is taxing emotionally, physically. So I was like, this was a matter of self-preservation, really. And it was a gift to be able to have this time to do it. And I wish everyone could take some time. It doesn't have to be 9 months, but just to do these kinds of things where you really take the time to encounter yourself. But for me, the wedding, no, it wasn't a real wedding, but it was in Zanzibar. I'd been in Tanzania for work, obviously doing some work around TB and malaria in children for the UN. And then I took a few days off afterwards and I always wanted to go to Zanzibar. I go on a safari, which that was another huge thing because I had been wanting to go on a safari forever. And I thought, oh, I'll do it when I get married. We'll do it on the honeymoon. Like, that's what you do. And I was like, well, you know, I'm getting up there. I don't want to wait any longer. And I was like, why do I have to be doing it with somebody or a partner? Why can't I just do it and experience this beauty on my own? So it was after, actually, it's almost like I did the honeymoon first and then I did the ceremony. But yeah, it was just this beautiful little place that I was staying at. And it was an empty beach and it was at sunrise and it was like, there were a bunch of cows. So not empty, there were cows kind of gliding along the sand, and it was just like the sun was rising, the sky was pink, and I had written these vows like the day before. I'd really thought, like, what are the things that I want to remember? Because, you know, it's funny, you could do a journey like this and then you could just get caught up in your life again and just go back to the same old, same old. That's why I feel like I always say self-work is daily work. We have to meditate every day. We have to, you know, I journal a lot, can write affirmations, whatever it is. So for me, it was writing down the things that I felt were really important for me to remember, you know, things like, I give myself permission to be whole and happy and never to doubt my own wholeness. I give myself permission to carve out my own authentic life path, even if it's different from the path that I, you know, was conditioned to think that I should have by this age, for example. It was empowering to write those vows and to silently kind of witness them. And, you know, like I say, I invited the universe to my wedding, but it was, you know, sometimes another point that I always like to make is I don't mind being alone. I actually kind of love it. And maybe I'm a weirdo, but I mean, I don't feel alone when I'm alone. Okay. And I think because I feel really connected to source. And I think when you're not connected to source, and it takes work, right, to get there. And that's part of the work that I've been doing the last few years. And I think that when you have a tragedy or when you've, you know, experienced the loss of a loved one, it forces you inward, right? It forces you to do this work. So I always say that I'd rather be alone than be with someone that I don't feel connected to. That makes me feel lonely. Or if you go to a dinner party and mm-hmm. people are just talking about dumb stuff, and I feel lonely in those moments, right? So you can be around people and be completely alone or feel completely yep. alone and lonely. And you could be by yourself on a beach in the middle of Africa and, you know, feel completely full and safe. And like you're in the hands of some force that's, you know, beyond something you could really put in words, right?
Well, this has been wonderful, Natasha. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We both were fans of the way you write. We love your story, and we're very excited to share this with our audience.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I'm so glad to hear that you've liked my book. And yeah, I can't wait to listen to more of your podcasts because they're great.
And if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Well, you can find me on Instagram, which is my new thing, or Twitter or Facebook, or just email me through my website, www.natashascripture.com. I want to like befriend readers and have these communities of women who are exploring these questions, because like, I don't have all the answers. So I love to talk about this stuff. So I welcome news and, you know, letters and emails from people. Definitely get in touch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Natasha. And we wish you all the best with your book and wish it will be a big success when it's released.
As always, thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in to the Desi Outsiders podcast. You can find Natasha on most social media platforms, and we've left her website in the show notes too. Be sure to read her book, and we're certain that this book will get you thinking. It's definitely something that has had us thinking about some very deep topics, and we're happy that we got to have this conversation with Natasha.
And before we leave, we just wanted to remind you that you can also find us on iTunes, Sovn, any other podcasting app, and do leave us a review, because it really does help us reach out to more people. You can follow our shenanigans on social media as well, especially on Instagram, where we're very active and we will happily reply to any messages that come our way. So until next week, I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.